Well, thank you so much for being here. And the story I'm going to tell, although was studied as a sort of nice problem that might appeal to Garrett, namely spins under temperature gradients, it had an unexpected twist, which I will introduce to you right now, and it's part of that thought-provoking part of my talk. That's what Yaroslav said, pedagogic and thought-provoking. So there you have it. And by the way, assume that it might be wrong, okay? So don't, I'm just quoting Hiro. Okay, so the story here is pretty innocuous. I wanted to understand what can one do such that you have a larger than normal thermoelectric coefficient. So essentially the first couple of slides will describe ways in which one can produce a thermoelectric anomaly in a Fermi system. The second part is going to question if something, a system that obeys the first couple of rules put in place can be found in a semiconductor. And if it is, can we find a system with spin orbit, Rajbadresselhaus, that can do the job? And then I'm going to present some calculations for charge and spin thermoelectrics in such systems and finish with my conclusions. So the major topic of interest was obviously the Seebeck coefficient, the proportionality coefficient between electric field and temperature gradients. Semi-classical transport theory says that when a certain perturbation is applied, the Fermi sphere is displaced along the direction of the perturbation. And in the case of the Seebeck coefficient, we are interested in the energy carried in respect to the Fermi energy, which leads to an almost complete cancellation at finite temperature, absolute cancellation at zero temperature, simply because the number of states that are advancing under the perturbation is exactly equal to the number of states that are being lost. So this is a physical reason for which this number is very small in electronic systems. What can we do to it to make it larger? Okay? So simple formula means I express the coefficient as a ratio of two sums. One is the conductivity here. This is the energy respect to the Fermi level that is being carried by each one of the states. This is, again, a very simple model. Single particle states are assumed. Each one of them carries energy, velocity. And under the perturbations, they are being, their occupation numbers are being displaced. Okay, which one of these guys would make the numerator higher? This is fixed and varies very weakly with the energy, so there is nothing you can do to this. Same for the velocity, but here it is, the big part of these formulas that can be modified, and how do I want to modify it? I want to make this guy a strongly varying function of energy, but I also want it to be anti-symmetric in respect to this difference, such that I avoid that necessary cancellation that happens for in normal circumstances. Okay, how do I create this rapidly varying function of energy? The way to perform this task is to introduce inelastic scattering. And the reason has to do with the fact that when inelastic scattering is introduced, the linear expression of the scattering probability out of a state k into state k prime acquires additional components which are functions of energy. Such variations, as it turns out, will have the benefit that for states that are advancing, so their energy is larger than epsilon Fermi. This is very small, but for states that are smaller than the energy Fermi, this becomes almost one. So this is the good news. Introducing inelastic scattering allows one to manipulate this fraction. The bad news, if you sum over all states, you cancel the effect because you'll have as many going in as many as come out. So let's see how we can further modify this. Well, it's clear that in order to adjust this balance, I need to envision a type of inelastic scattering which is one directional, meaning going from k to k prime, you gain energy. Going from k prime to k, you lose energy somehow. And the standard case of something like this is scattering on magnetic impurities, where the value of the scattering probability depends on the relative alignment of the spin of the electron and that of the magnetic impurity. Still, this is not enough if your system is paramagnetic, meaning you have as many spin ups as you have down. So this picture of scattering processes in which you gain energy and lose the energy has to be augmented with an imbalance in the populations of spins that undergo this particular type of scattering. In other words, I'm looking for a system that is doped with magnetic impurities so that I can have spin-dependent scattering, but I'm also interested in finding a system where the two spin populations are uneven. Where can I find something like this? And I want to be current, meaning, you know, everybody's doing spin orbits, so do I have a system like this in the modern world? The thing is, in the 60s, there is a lot of literature being published on such thermodynamic anomalies in metals with spin density waves. Spin density wave, as I will come back later, is a special type of spin alignment, which is essentially the basis for itinerant anti-ferromagnetism. So once I realized this, I started thinking, okay, where do I know about a nice system that presumably has such a spin alignment? That would be the 2D electron system with linear Rajbadresal house in a special regime, namely when alpha and beta are equal. And 7 years ago, a very nice paper was published by a Stanford group which claimed that this type of system, in this particular case, exhibits a helical spin arrangement, as in spin density wave type of rotating spin arrangement. So at this point in my work, I said, okay, so I have my system, I have my story, let me just calculate, you know, the thermoelectric coefficient, and I'll have a nice problem, and I'm done with it. And this is where my story got an abrupt turn, which unfortunately I didn't expect. This is a thought-provoking part of my talk. Because as I was trying to reconcile my own understanding of spin density waves with the results of this paper, I realized that something might be really wrong in that prediction. I know this might sound like blasphemy, but please bear with the next couple of slides. Okay, so in a 2D with SOI, with the spin orbit interaction, linear. The cubic term apparently can disturb this arrangement, but is usually small, so I'll just neglect it. The cubic Dressel house. So linear Hamiltonian, and through a simultaneous unitary transformation in spin space and a real rotation of axes in momentum space, it can be put in this form. Again, for the special case where alpha and beta are equal. And in this rotated coordinate system, turns out that the Hamiltonian of a single electron starts looking like this. In other words, the kinetic part for motion along a certain direction involves the spin. Okay, so what is the essence of the PRL paper I made reference to? These are the single particle states that solve that Hamiltonian, right? Plane waves, kinetic energy part along x, plane waves. And I insist on this because these details are extremely important for the rest of the developments. The PRL made the following very good observation. The spectrum of up spins can be placed on top of the spectrum of the down spins if you do this translation. The translation made the gist of the argument because essentially it tells everybody that they obtained fully degenerate spectrum for up and down electrons. Following that, they introduced the lowering and raising spin operators, which were enabled by the fact that for this particular arrangement of k's, the up and downs share the same energy. Based on these definitions, they also proved that these guys commute with the kinetic part of the Hamiltonian. So notice that the difference in energies shows up here. The energies are equal. These commutators are all zero. These two guys are conserved. From there, they said, well, the sum, and obviously the y version with the difference, will generate such non-zero matrix elements, since the states involved in this k and k plus 2q have different phases here, right? When you do a matrix element between k and k plus q, you end up with a residual e to minus iqr, which is the part that gives the cosine here, right? You have real, you do the real plus complex conjugate. This is the cosine. Again, the cosine comes by overlapping e to I kr and e to I k plus 2 qr. So this was the gist of that paper. Based on this result, they argued we have a spin density wave which acquires a spatial rotation. We call it a helical density wave.
So this is for the very special case when we're
alpha, yes, alpha equal beta, yes.
Right. Okay, so you have this nesting vector, which is this Q, essentially.
Correct,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Again, I am just repeating the argument of that paper, okay? And it's assumed alpha and beta are equal.
Right.
It's very important, otherwise this thing doesn't work for them nor for me,
right.
So.
Helical means that indeed the spin texture is rotating.
Helical,
right?
Means that in real space,
is rotating.
Okay. But one thing which I would like to draw your attention at is the fact that this result is necessarily connected with this picture or embodied by this invariance equation. One thing which I would like you to notice is the following. If in all this theory you set Q equals zero, this picture right here would correspond to an ordinary paramagnetic Fermi liquid. Nothing, however, changes in the argument. You can still make the same argument for a paramagnetic Fermi liquid. And guess what? You'll end up that in a paramagnetic Fermi liquid, whose spins will be along the z direction, this guy is along the z direction, you end up with transverse polarizations.
But the infinite wavelength.
Well, this is one. But this is a problem. You see, when you do this picture here, they completely neglected that big chunk of action that happens in Fermi systems, which is a Coulomb interaction. In other words, when you do this arrangement like this, you end up with a paramagnetic system. In order for this operator to generate a non-zero result, the single particle state you have to consider here, which were considered in that paper, have to be linear combinations of this, right? This is an off-diagonal operator between states in a Fermi liquid It has non-zero value only if each one of these phi k's is a linear combination of these for both spins. But that is a state that by default is unstable because the overall energy of that state is higher than the paramagnetic configuration. That system cannot possibly exist. So, one more time. Once you do this, your system is simply made out of two parabolas, paramagnetic states. A paramagnetic system is never going to admit a single particle state's linear combination of opposite spins. So, once I understood this, I said, okay, let's see where we go from here. And to start the argument for my solution to the problem, let me do that pedagogical part. And I apologize to all those of you who are familiar with these issues, but I feel that for the flow of my presentation is necessary to go through this slide. So Fermi liquid, and again, the Rajbah electron system in a semiconductor is a Fermi liquid. The minimization of the energy has to be done in the presence of the total interaction, which means you have to include the Coulomb interaction. And the known states, natural states, of such a system are obviously the paramagnetic distribution, where you occupy each state inside a sphere or a disk by two spins of opposite directions. And thus, you minimize the radius of this disk, which means you minimize the kinetic energy. But what happens is these guys have reduced exchange. Exchange is a negative contribution to the Coulomb interaction. And because you reduce the exchange, the Coulomb interaction is slightly higher. What else would this system want to do? If you apply a magnetic field, you increase the exchange, right? Because all the spins become parallel. And they like that orientation to increase the negative exchange interaction. So you minimize the potential energy by aligning all the spins parallel. But there is a problem. Pauli says you cannot put two spins of the same orientation on the same state. So by doing the ferromagnetic alignment, you inflate the Fermi sphere, and the kinetic energy becomes so large that always the energy in the ferromagnetic state is larger than the energy of the paramagnetic state. That's why you need a magnetic field to make such a system ferromagnetic. By default, by itself, is not going to become ferromagnetic.
Is this true for any of the three possible spin orientations?
Just a second. Let me finish. No. I'm not done. Just a second. All right. So this was the state of affairs where in two papers in the 60s, and I know 60s sounds like ancient, you know, Stone Age type of physics, the idea of spin density wave was proposed. And how was this proposed? The spin density wave formalism, the idea of spin density wave was proposed as a point of instability for the paramagnetic phase. In other words, by introducing a model in which the electron spin is allowed to freely rotate in the momentum space, these two papers argue that I can, you know, increase exchange, right? Because those guys will get some parallel states in which the exchange will be increased, without, however, paying the price in kinetic energy, without inflating the Fermi sphere so the system becomes unstable. The story, obviously, is very long. The problem was this was a model applied in metals, and because in metals, up and downs have a degenerate spectrum, you had to introduce a certain spatial separation. All right, so what is my solution to the problem before? The same energy spectrum, same plane waves. But then, what I think it's a key point in this problem. It's not necessarily that these two lines will overlap, but rather that they intersect right here. This is a point where the energy of the up electron equals the one of the down electron. What is important to realize is that in this system with spin orbit, this guy shows up naturally. It's proportional to alpha, the spin orbit coupling.
But where is your Fermi energy? It's very much up, and then it doesn't matter where they intersect, right?
I don't discuss right now where the Fermi energy is. I'll connect to that later on. Right now, all I want to show is that, in my opinion, the true issue here is the fact that these two opposite energy spectra, opposite spin energy spectra, are degenerate. And essentially, the degeneracy at zero produces the following possibility, and this is actually the essence of the spin density formation, or as we see, other types of anti-ferromagnetic ordering. Because of this, electrons have an option of lowering the total energy by flipping the spin right here and gapping the spectrum. And once they do this, the question becomes, is this gapping permanent? Or what are the circumstances in which it exists? Because, as I tried to infer earlier, the instability, the spin instability that appears here, leads to a long-ranged ordered magnetic phase only if it's a collective phenomenon, which means I need the Coulomb interaction to come in and see that indeed, under these circumstances, the system achieves a lower energy than paramagnetic. All right, so in order to convince you, this is a parallel between what happens in a spiral spin density wave case. I call that the uniform Fermi liquid because in a regular Fermi liquid, there is no Q a priori determined. In metals, ZQ is usually considered to be 2KF because it has to be the self-consistent result of electron-electron scattering. And since everything is frozen inside the sphere, the only option is at the very surface. So you look at Qs that are equal to the diameter of the Fermi disk or Fermi sphere. Okay, so this is the general spin density wave theory as it was presented in those papers in the 60s. This is what happens in the 2D plus spin orbit at alpha equals beta. In a uniform Fermi liquid, you start with this simple Hamiltonian. The electron spectrum is completely degenerate for up and downs. Here, you don't have a degeneracy. Where does it go from here? The spin density wave theory says if I want to create a spin instability and allow for the spin rotation with the hope of lowering the total energy of the state, I have to create the distortion in K-space such that these guys become separate. On the other hand here, naturally the separation is provided by the spin orbit, which introduces that vector Q. And here is the gist of this problem. If this is the point of degeneracy, the end result can be described in terms of two quasi-particles, two new quasi-particles that are being formed. The property of those quasi-particles is that their spin structure is a linear combination of up and downs. Notice that in the case of the Fermi liquid, as I said, the Q has to be introduced. So you have to pretend that, yes, I can see the state of the single particle system being displaced for up and downs by these two Qs. So when one tries to describe these new quasi-particles, you involve plane waves of argument K, and plane waves of argument k plus 2q. Here, your degeneracy is smack in the middle. It's already done by the spin orbit coupling. So the only components that can describe such two quasi particles have to be both at argument k, because these are the plane waves of the up and down states. So now when you are doing off-diagonal elements between states like this, you apply a sigma plus or a sigma minus between these psi k's, and as I try to explain, one of these guys will come complex conjugate. When you multiply the two phases, you end up with an e to I 2k, 2qr from sigma plus, and the complex conjugate for sigma minus, and that's how you end up with spatial effects. Here, again, in this part, the spacing was already done, so all my waves are at AKR. There are no spatial effects left because they cancel each other. So if one calculates the polarization on each one of these two states, in the case of the spin density waves, as they were discussed in the 60s, indeed, you end up with a standard helical configuration where the transverse components, okay, this is x and y, have a certain amplitude, but then they rotate around a spatial direction that is given by q with a certain periodicity. And that's why they are called helical, not helical. They were initially called spiral spin density waves. The name of this paper was Giant Spiral Spin Density Waves. On the other hand here, there is no spatial direction because it cancels out. Since I'm dealing with states corresponding to the same k, I have only one component. Turns out that the other one cancels because this is an odd function, as I'll show in a little bit. So the gist of this, which actually took me by surprise, because that's not what I intended to discover. I was simply trying to understand the paper and then doing my own, you know, Seebeck calculation on this state and hope to be done with it. And in a way, I was shocked, because it seems to me that there is this big misunderstanding on how you end up with a spatial dependence in the case of spin density waves and what gives that dependence. I have to say that in the original papers, the Coulomb interaction was never considered. It was just a standard kinetic energy thing. And if you look at kinetic only doesn't say a lot. So this is a picture from one of the famous experiments that followed. And this is a spectroscopy experiment. So they were measuring diffusion times of excited particles. The thing is, when you do physical quantities on these states, unless you actually have an experiment set up to look at how the polarization moves in real space, such as with neutron scattering or something, there is no way you can tell the phases. So this experiment measured, indeed, the long lifetimes of these helical spin waves, which, again, has the same result if you do the spatial dependent phase or if you do just the anti-ferromagnetic alignment that I explained earlier. So in my opinion, all these guys are not doing this funny flipping or anything. They are simply aligning themselves to that, and that's it. So this is simply an itinerant anti-ferromagnet instead of a fancy helical spin density wave. Well, a spin density wave is an itinerant anti-ferromagnet. It's the same thing, except that involves this real space variation, which, again, in my opinion, is not present is a Rajbadarsahau's equal strength system. So this being the case, I was at least happy that my intended problem didn't completely mess up, because even if it's not a spin density wave, I can still do my uneven population, and I can still look at various properties. Before going there, however, one is to look if this state is stable. And the stability of such a state can be explained only within the context of analyzing the whole energy of the system. In other words, I'm counting on long-range order to be established, and that means all electrons cooperate. And the gist of this model for spin density waves is the following. If you have paramagnetic states, meaning all electron states are degenerate, which gives them, as in the persistent helical state papers, the ability to flip between the two spectra, right, as if they are free to switch their spins at random, you'll have a crowd problem. They will all try to do that, and it's an impossibility. Here, in the spin density wave spectra, as I showed you, you have just one point of degeneracy, which means you can do this process one electron at a time. And when you do it like that, there is a chance that they will all cooperate in some way, and then they will flip the spins by lowering the total energy of the system. And this was a major problem, again, in the theory of metallic Fermi liquids, because there, Q was fixed at a certain level. You cannot mess up with the densities and so on. So this wasn't a particularly successful theory then. Yes?
I'm sorry for being so pedantic. But in order to access this degeneracy point, you need to have a Fermi energy of the order of spin orbital energy, which is really tiny. I mean, you have so low density in your fermionic system, right, that the Coulomb interaction will indeed play a very important role. But this, I would not call it Fermi liquid anymore. Because you don't start with the concept that kinetic energy is much larger compared to potential energy.
Well, okay, so just a second. I am starting from the concept that I have a many-body system with kinetic energy and Coulomb interaction. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I'm not making any a priori assumption on which one is bigger. I'm simply pursuing the standard theory for magnetic instabilities, which is something that has been done not just in the context of spin density waves in metals, but also in various semiconductor arrangements, such as double quantum wells, super lattices, all in magnetic fields, right? There is a whole body of literature that has Shankar Dasarma as main author, which is called Candid Antiferromagnetic States. Okay, this is the same thing.
If you have a Fermi liquid, you better count your excitations from the chemical potential, from the Fermi liquid.
Okay, so
and therefore, let me ask a question. Therefore, you calculate your polarizability, for example, which will might or might not have some instability associated with 2kF transfer. If you have a nesting, namely if you have a congruent part of your Fermi surface or flat part, which is even better, then your polarization loop or susceptibility diverges or is picked at 2kF, and this is why you have some vector for instability, but you start with, say, with excitations counted from the Fermi energy. You do something differently, right?
Yes, I am doing the sort of standard spin instability theory as it was done in all this literature before this particular problem. And again, I'm not necessarily thinking Landau theory of Fermi liquids. I am pretty much thinking just a many-body system with a kinetic and a Hamiltonian part.
But what if you have Wigner crystal at the starting point, which your Coulomb interaction is much, sorry, probably I am asking.
Yes, but I am doing this problem in a particular system, which is this Rajbah semiconductor stuff. I'm not doing Wigner's crystal. Experiments were done at 4, 10 to 12 centimeter to minus 2 density, okay? So these were sort of metallic, heavily doped semiconductors.
So is it more like a sort of mean field Hadron?
Yes, yes, that's where I'm going. Mean field Hadron Fock.
Mean field, I assume that RS is of the order of 1. But here RS would be, how big is it, 20, 30?
No. This is, again, I'll get there, okay? So, to see what is going on here, traditionally, one sets up a complete Hamiltonian with kinetic energy and potential energy. And in order to see what is going on, this Hamiltonian is linearized by performing this type of orthogonal canonical transformation. So I give up my single electron operators and move on to two others that will describe these states that have this nice property of having different spin compositions. Okay, so this is where I'm going, as Dimi said. I'm going to a Hadron-Fock. And the Hadron-Fock theory is quite simple, and it essentially assumes that I can factor somehow those products of operators by allowing a certain configuration of the ground state. And this is the major issue in establishing such ground states. Namely, in order for calculating these numbers, you need to know what kind of ground state you have, which ground state in turn is the result of having all these averages calculated. So once you do this, you realize that the terms involved in the Hadron-Fock approximation of the Coulomb interaction will now have two major components. One is the regular exchange, which happens when the spins are parallel. Everybody agrees on that. And then the second part, and this is a fundamental input of the spin density wave theory. Without this, you won't have density waves, is to allow for this ground state average to be different from zero. That implicitly assumes that your ground state does not have only parallel spins, but also allows for the rotation. And this is actually the term that generates any kind of magnetic order you might have. In particular, anti-ferromagnetic here, because they simply assume that there is an exchange between operators that correspond to opposite spins. So this is what the Hamiltonian looks like when you do that canonical transformation, and then everything is put together. This is the potential that represents the exchange component between these particles that don't have the same spin. Well, at finite temperature, you can throw in the entropy, and then you verify that this canonical transformation conserves the number of particles, and then you minimize the whole thing. There are three parameters here. The first and most important is this variational parameter that describes the rotation in the momentum space. So you differentiate that in respect to the angle, and then that was an equation that combines that anti-ferromagnetic potential with the two single particle energies calculated in the Hadron-Fock. The energies itself depend on the angle. So this is basically an implicit integral equation, because all its components depend through these sums on the result. When the energy is differentiated in respect to temperature, one gets the two quasi-particle energies, which are those dotted curves in the single particle spectra, which acquire this particular form. G, from this expression, acquires a new name, If you take the difference of these two values, notice that at the previous point of degeneracy, when these guys are almost equal, G becomes the difference between those two energies, and it's called the spin density wave gap. This is similar to the theory of superconductivity, except that the pairing is done differently there. But it's the same algorithm. So this is essentially the equation satisfied by the gap, in which it is assumed that in order to minimize the total energy, the end state will produce this difference, and G is essentially the self-consistent solution of this equation. And by the way, I don't know if you probably have seen, most of you, Majorana fermion papers. Did you see a picture like this? There is one by Staudemeyer and Jason Alicia. They are calculating the Majorana energy spectrum. They start from two things like this, and they have a much better picture than mine here. But that's a different, again, different. But the idea is, once you have a degeneracy in single particle spectra, you gap it. Well, and this is a pretty difficult equation to solve. And now I'm going to get to your comments, okay? Notice that by default, this equation is always having a solution, which is G equals zero, which simply means I don't have any gapping. Each one of these guys is keeping its spin state. There is no rotation in the momentum space. And I have to hurry up because I'm late. Now, if you do a sort of easy integration, you can pretend that the Coulomb interaction there is a constant. The states involved are squeezed in this type of box. And you can end up with a solution. However, this solution is not necessarily the one that minimizes the free energy of the system, because you neglect the exchange parts of the single particle energies. So this is sort of, yes, I can always have a solution. Notice that the solution is proportional to the length of that displacement vector. So now, yes?
So can you go back to the...
Yes. Yes.
So you mean then that you open a gap? I mean, you mentioned these works dealing with Majorana, but in their case, they have an external magnetic field, which breaks time reversal symmetry.
Well, I'm telling you only this because I'm not an expert in that field, and I was just reading this paper of Jason Alicia and Staudemeyer.
No, but my question is, here, I mean, even if you have Coulomb interactions, time reversal symmetry is preserved. And how are you open a gap?
Well, the gap is open when you try to solve that minimization condition for the total energy.
But this is not an artifact of mean field approximation?
Excuse me?
This is not an artifact of mean field? I mean, if you consider quantum fluctuations...
Okay, let me explain that there are books written on this particular subject, if the mean field approximation is enough or not. And the guy who endowed this building, Walter Cohn, was dead set on having this situation show up in real metals, because according to him, once you put in correlations, you destroy this nice arrangement. Okay? Here, however, again, that discussion was about Fermi systems. Here, presumably, you can always find a value of Q. This is a driven transition, okay? Because you have the spin orbit showing up and changing your physics. It's not a spontaneous thing like in the case of pure Fermi liquids. Q has a certain value, and presumably you can always massage Coulomb strength, Q, all these things to end up with a solution. All right.
So when you say it's driven, what is it driven by?
By the spin orbit, by the fact that you have a Q naturally embedded in the system.
Right, but then if it's, okay.
That means driven versus spontaneous. You have a Q, which is part of the system in this case, but that Q is part of what drives this change of phase.
But Q is not really driving the force, right?
No. By driving, I mean it's a component of the Hamiltonian that favors this transition.
But so what's the difference between this and spontaneous?
Spontaneous means that Q should appear as a result of Coulomb interaction alone.
Okay,
so now I'm ashamed to come to the Boltzmann equation slide because it has a bad reputation in these circles. But it's still a good thing to, you know, to do a quick calculation, which I'm going to go through very fast. So you do the calculation, define the current, apply the mod formula to calculate the Z-back out of the conductivity. And the only special thing is you use a Fermi-Golden rule that involves not just the usual isotropic scattering, but also spin spin magnetic impurity scattering. And essentially now I am putting all the ingredients in those recipe I presented at the beginning of the talk, and it's just algebra, okay? So it's just a lot of calculation, but essentially, but I am not going to be very specific about this because there are lots of unknowns in this experiment. So this is from Nita's latest paper on detecting this state with alpha equal beta in a quantum well. So their Q is pretty much just 4% of the Fermi momentum. So it's pretty small. This is how you calculate when you look at the miniband, and this is a result. And this is a result, again, the result was built according to a certain recipe. So this feature right here, which tells me that for a certain type of scattering, I can actually achieve increments in S versus the normal value at the same temperature, is simply a result of having this impurity, magnetic impurity scattering, which determines how big the peak is and at what temperature. And one here on this scale corresponds to 70 Kelvin. So the temperature is not dismally small. It's about 10 to 15 Kelvin. But, as I said, you can arrange a lot of action out of all these parameters. Essentially, you would like to have this Q larger. Again, in these experiments of Nita and pretty much of everybody who did this regime, the doping is extremely intense, so you are having a metallic system, essentially. And the conclusions of this talk would be that if I want Coulomb interaction in my system with spin orbit at alpha equal beta, the ordering of the magnetic spins would be antiferromagnetic rather than helical. In other words, there is no helix in the spin helix state. If this state exists, it's extremely susceptible to all sorts of conditions. In other words, the gap is conditioned by density, by the strength of the Coulomb interaction, what kind of interaction you have, and so on. Again, in the 90s, Shankar Dasarma and all the other people who worked on something like this, but in quantum Hall systems, had phase diagrams and so on. Basically, you do a parsing depending on what parameters you choose to modify and see exactly what situations arise. And of course, this is function of temperature. So again, there is a critical temperature above which nothing happens. And a way of testing, a different way of testing this state would be try to do some electric measurements, dope slightly with magnetic impurities, and see if you get that big bump. Thank you for your attention. And I wanted to thank Al and Gabriele Giuliani, the best scientists probably in knowing spin density waves, who unfortunately are not with us, but it's not their fault if I didn't make myself clear or I might have misinterpreted something here. Thank you so much.
Okay, we have a little bit of time left for questions, so we should.
Mm-hmm. No, we have time left. Yeah, go ahead.
Did I answer you correctly that because of this gap, you have not only kind of singularity in your density of state, but your derivative of the density of state with respect to energy is also huge. This is why, because both your numerator is big and denominator is relatively small. So this is effect of density of state.
No. The reason I have a big bump in the numerator in determining S is because I put by hand, okay, Z impurity scattering on magnetic spins, which actually gave me those factors that are close to one for certain types of energies and almost zero for the others. That's where the big bump is coming from. But the gapping of the system allows me to argue these are states where the spin population is not uniform. Hence, I will have more extras than minuses. I know I haven't convinced you, but actually, part of this thing is in big Z, is discussed very, very, in very much detail in this big fat book written by Gabriele Giuliani and Giovanni Vignale on quantum Fermi liquids. There is a big fat chapter there about spin density waves.
So let's see whether I understood this properly. So you say that this persistent spin helix for alpha equals beta is affected by Coulomb interaction.
I am saying it doesn't exist.
Without it exists, without Coulomb interaction?
No, it doesn't exist. It's a problem with the original theory. Or at least that's what I think.
That is so simple, I don't think you can make that wrong.
Well, it is wrong because, again, you assume free spin flipping in a paramagnetic system. And in order to end up with off-diagonal matrix elements in a pure paramagnetic system, you have to assume that in that paramagnet, you will have linear combinations of up and down spins.
Yes, but this is stabilized by the spin orbit.
No, the spin orbit was eliminated. Once you displace the two spectra on top of each other, the spin orbit is out. You have just two degenerate electron curves on top of each other. They use the fact that they have at all k points the same energy to argue that, yes, I can build these states, which are superpositions between up and down spins. Okay.
But then the next step is that you recover the Q modulation if you take
not in space. You have Q modulation just in K space, but not in real space. Because my ingredients are different than their ingredients.
Are there more questions, please? Carol's after quiet from today.
Well, thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much.